Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1047, interview number 16 with Jim Biagemio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 9th of the year 2019. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airways Jim Biagemio, the author of, among other titles, The Triumphal Destiny Betrayed, which is the focal point of these interviews. Jim, welcome back once again to our airways.
Okay, good evening, Dave.
We concluded our last interview with an article from the Huffington Post from October of 2016, an observation of LGBT month. And the author, I've forgotten his name, a guy named Rodney Wilson.
Rodney Wilson.
Yeah, whom I'd never heard of, basically repeated the established BS referred to us by James Phelan, that Garrison had no case at all. And made it out that this was that Garrison was after Clay Shaw, who was completely innocent and a Wilsonian liberal, FDR liberal, as we have seen. He was anything but that. And recall that newer listeners, the CIA's go-to man on the JFK assassination, Ray Rocha, felt that Garrison would be able to get a conviction of Clay Shaw. And Jonathan Blackmer, the House Select Committee on Assassinations assistant counsel for the New Orleans area, wrote a memo which he stated that Clay Shaw was either a cutout to, or either one of the planners of, or a cutout to the planners of the JFK assassination. And yet, younger listeners who would be reading the Huffington Post would be getting the nonsense generated by James Phelan. And the article, the Huffington Post piece, also made reference to Johnny Carson's hatchet job on Jim Garrison. Mort Saul, the brilliant political comedian, wrote in his autobiography, Heartland, back in 1976, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And it was actually Mort Saul, I believe, Jim, who got Jim Garrison. He was one of Jim Garrison's assistants. He was an amateur participant, so to speak, who was on the positive side of the ledger. And he got Jim Garrison his interview or his appearance on The Tonight Show, bearing in mind that The Tonight Show was on NBC, and we've spoken about their deep politics, and that Walter Sheridan aired his hit piece on NBC. In the movie JFK, Johnny Carson was played by John Larroquette. If you would relate to us the story of the Garrison appearance on The Tonight Show, and then some of what Mort Saul's wife at the time, Chyna Lee, related in supplement to that.
This started because Mort Saul was working as a dollar-a-year deputy for Jim Garrison, all right? Mort Saul, I don't think most of the young generation is familiar with him, but back in the late 50s, early 60s, Mort Saul was a very big name in the entertainment business. He was really one of the first of the really intelligent comedians, you know, like George Carlin, okay, or somebody like that. And he had carved out a kind of multifaceted career. He actually co-hosted the Oscars one year. He was a recurrent guest on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was a very big variety show back in those days, which I'm sure me and Dave remember. I'm not sure very many other people remember. Okay, and he was on the cover of Time magazine. He had more than one local TV and radio show in L.A., and he was a friend of John F. Kennedy, okay? And he was interested in the whole assassination. And so he went down there to interview Garrison for his local LA show, and he talked to him for an hour or two, and he came away convinced that Garrison was the real deal. All right? And so he went to work for him, all right, thereby giving up rather a lot, a significant amount of money, okay? He made an appearance on a Tonight Show, and towards the end of the appearance, he talked about the JFK case, and he turned to the audience and said, "How many of you would like to hear from Jim Garrison in person?" And there was a rousing ovation. So Carson was kind of trapped into having him on. All right. And so the next week, he announced that he would have Jim Garrison on. But this was the problem. The problem was that this occurred after the Walter Sheridan program, all right, which had been sanctioned by David and Robert Sarnoff, David the father, Robert the son. And they essentially ran NBC at that time, okay? And so there was no way in the world that they were going to make Garrison look good after they had already made him look bad. So Johnny Carson was heavily briefed, okay, by the NBC lawyers. And from the moment the show began, it wasn't an interview. It was a confrontation. All right? And now, I think we should bring one other point in here. At this stage in his career, Johnny Carson was not the omnipowerful person he was later on. When he got into a contract dispute with NBC a couple years later, that's when he began to be his own producer and to actually own The Tonight Show. At this point, he wasn't. So he still had to take orders from NBC headquarters, all right? And so this ended up being, you can actually hear it online if you want to. There's more than one place that has it. I've happened to see some excerpts from it. And it was really pretty awful, okay? All right, and so at one point in the show, Carson was asking Garrison, "So why would Lyndon Johnson be considering, you know, covering up the death of John F. Kennedy? I don't understand that. Why would he do something like that?" And he had done this the entire program. And so at this moment, Garrison says, "Well, I don't know. Why don't you ask him, Johnny?" And the entire audience cracked up, okay? You know, and Carson ended up looking like a fool, all right? And he was very angry about the whole thing. And when the show ended and Mort Saul came out from behind the stage, okay, Carson said, "You will never be on this show again." And by the way, he made good on that threat. It wasn't until Jay Leno took over The Tonight Show that Mort Saul was back on the show. That's how bitter and that's how angry Johnny Carson was. And by the way, I have to also say something about this. It was so bad that Carson and his production company lied about not having the show. Okay? You know, there are ways you can get clips from it today. All right? They made up this excuse that it burned in a fire or something, which, you know, it simply did not really happen. All right? So that was one instance of how, for example, the Sarnoffs ended up making sure that Jim Garrison did not redeem himself after Walter Sheridan's hatchet job.
By the way, we should interject at this point briefly, as you have written about in Destiny Betrayed, the Sarnoffs themselves have a long history of collaboration with the intelligence community, and Alan Dulles going back to the genesis of Radio Free Europe. And we spoke about that a couple of weeks ago. So that's something that listeners should keep in mind. Also, something that critics of Jim Garrison have mentioned, Jim, and or critics of the notion that there was a conspiracy, they've said that, well, Bobby Kennedy would have done something. He was attorney general. He would not have allowed a conspiracy to go forward. And by the way, we'll talk about LBJ when we get to Vietnam and what happened there in a future interview, Jim. But you write about the fact that China Lee, who was Mort Saul's wife at the time, had some interesting information about Robert Kennedy and his interest in Jim Garrison. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, this was when Mort was playing a club in L.A., okay? And they had met at John Frankenheimer's house, all right, the big-time Hollywood movie director, all right? And Bobby was there. Happened to be in town at this time. And Mort went in to town to do a show. And then his wife was waiting for him when he got back. You know, and she said, God, I wish you wouldn't have left me alone. And he goes, why? What's wrong? After you left, Bobby Kennedy was badgering me all night about what's Mort digging up? What does Garrison have? You know, what's going on down there in New Orleans? All right. So this is obviously something that Bobby didn't want to do in public. You know, so he did it through these back channels that were available to him. Okay. So, you know, the idea that Bobby Kennedy was not interested in what happened to his brother is pretty much baloney, as we know today. You know, he was very interested in what happened to JFK. And some of us believe, maybe you also, Dave, that this is one of the reasons that Bobby Kennedy was killed.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he, by the way, his interest in his brother's murder and his stated intention to reopen the case when he got elected is a matter of public record and relayed in a number of different sources. You mentioned, Jim, I have not read the book, but you spoke very highly of a recent publication of A Lie Too Big to Fail by Lisa Peace, a collaborator of yours. I don't know if she goes into that, but there certainly is yet another recent book about the conspiratorial murder of Robert F. Kennedy that people could read about.
Right. It's a very good book. I wrote the introduction for it. I'd recommend that everybody listening to the program, go ahead and get that book. In my opinion, it's the best book about the Robert Kennedy assassination that there is right now.
Does she go into Bobby's interest in his brother's murder?
Oh, you know something? That's actually something I don't recall right now.
Okay.
It's a pretty long book. Okay, so I don't have a total recall of everything she wrote about.
No sweat.
All right.
No problem.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering about that. There are numerous other sources. James Douglas, in his book JFK and the Unspeakable, speaks about that. And also there is discussion of that in The Plot to Kill King by William Pepper as well. So there are numerous sources about that.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We were talking At the end of our last interview, Jim, there was a Huffington Post story, but you know, not necessarily to attack Rodney Wilson, the author of that. I know nothing about him. He appears to have written very quickly because the word assassin was misspelled in the first edition of the article. And he made reference not only to the Johnny Carson interview of Jim Garrison, but also the smearing of Garrison's investigation as a homosexual thrill killing, or investigating it because it was a homosexual thrill killing, and citing correctly that Clay Shaw was gay, and then going on to relate Jim Phelan's fantasies about Clay Shaw, about he was a Wilsonian, FDR liberal, et cetera, et cetera. One of the other media hatchet people and someone who networked with Walter Sheridan and James Thalen and others was James Kirkwood. Tell us about James Kirkwood.
Okay. James Kirkwood was an up-and-coming young playwright and novelist. Now, Clay Shaw had some ambitions of being a writer himself, right? And so, since Kirkwood was gay and Shaw was gay, all right, they networked in that, you know, with Tennessee Williams and those kind of writers, all right? And well, Tennessee Williams ended up writing a blurb for Kirkwood's book. So Shaw was looking for somebody to go ahead and write a hatchet job against Jim Garrison, all right? And he wanted that particular spin placed on it, that somehow that Garrison had somehow singled out Shaw because he was a closeted homosexual, all right? And that was a this is complete garbage, okay? I mean, we now have the declassified files, all right? And the reason that Garrison decided to go ahead and pursue Shaw was simply because he had too many witnesses who revealed to him that Shaw used the alias of Clay Bertrand, all right? And so that's the reason he latched on to Shaw, okay? But anyway, Shaw wanted to use that as a defense, and he got this up-and-coming young writer, Jim Kirkwood, to go ahead and write a book about the whole investigation, about Jim Garrison, slamming Garrison. You know, and this is one of the devices that he used, okay? He borrowed it from James Phelan that somehow Garrison somehow figured that, like the Leopold Leb case, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the famous case in Chicago in the 1920s, where the two young intellectual kids went ahead and they wanted to see if they could perform the perfect crime, all right? And so Phelan tried to typify this as that, okay? Now, to show you just how ridiculous, okay, that this whole thing is, how would Guy Bannister figure into that, you know? And also, as Garrison came to think later, all right, that his idea was that Alan Dulles was the guy behind the whole thing, all right? So how would Alan Dulles, who had numerous affairs, you know, even though he was married, okay, how would he figure into something like that? You know, it's just utter and complete nonsense. And having been through as many as Garrison's files as anybody, I believe, I don't think there's maybe one or two people in the entire world who have seen more of that than I have. I've never seen anything that comes close to insinuating that. So this was just a cheap shot to kind of somehow say that, see, this is the kind of DA who preys upon people with homosexual secrets. you know, preying upon a guy's weakness, you know, that kind of thing. And but the thing is, anybody who's ever studied Garrison's career would know that's exactly the kind of guy he wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. The sneer at the time, Jim Garrison was a big guy. He was 6'6", and he was dubbed the Jolly Green Giant because he, quote, put fruits and nuts in the can, unquote. That was the popular sneer of Jim Garrison. Oh, exactly. And he was a defender of human rights. It's a little bit like there's a book called The Hidden Hitler. And Adolf Hitler was apparently a bisexual or a closeted gay as well. That would be like making the Holocaust out to be a homosexual thrill killing. You know, I mean, it's just stupid, just plain dumb. And and yet, obviously, as Mort Sahl observed, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And apparently, you know, that one has survived, and Rodney Wilson apparently was subject to that when he, perhaps in good faith, wrote that horrible pile of fresh fertilizer for the Huffington Post. But again, this is what young people are being subjected to at this point in time. And that is one of the things that I think is so important about your book, is it not only shows what happened with the crime and with to Garrison's investigation, but how the media behaved in connection with this and how they have conveyed an utterly false impression of that. You also write of a fellow named David Chandler. Tell us about David Chandler, Jim.
David Chandler was a Time Life reporter who also freelanced a little bit for the local newspapers in New Orleans. The odd thing about David Chandler is that him and Garrison were actually friends, all right? But Chandler was obsessed with putting a mafia spin on the Kennedy assassination, all right? And so he began to cooperate with these guys, saying that somehow Garrison was compromised, and this is the reason that he did not want to include Carlos Marcello, you know, as one of the conspirators who killed JFK. And this was another smear against Jim Garrison, all right? And this ended up going on for a number of years until, the files were declassified, and we found out that Garrison actually did consider organized crime, you know, as one of the suspects, but he never could surface enough evidence, you know, to actually have them being the major player in the conspiracy. In fact, in a story that he did, that Garrison did in 1976 for New Orleans Magazine, he actually said in that article that his view of the conspiracy was that it was a triangle between the CIA, the Cuban exiles, and the mob. He actually said that. Mm-hmm. In that interview. So, again, this is nothing. This is something that really has little or no basis in fact, but was used by the mainstream media. In fact, this particular angle, Life magazine used it to say that somehow Garrison was in bed with the mob in an article that Chandler co-wrote in Life magazine in late 1967. All right? And again, to me, this is another example of just how bad, actually terrible, that the mainstream media was on both Jim Garrison and the JFK case, that they would stoop to these kind of lows in order to go ahead and smear the messenger because they didn't want the public to believe that there really was a conspiracy to kill JFK, which, unfortunately, there was, you know.
Most assuredly. And again, the media hatchet people worked directly with the intelligence services. They had worked as we have seen, with Clayshaw's defense team, and they are the prism through which the Media Hatchet people, they work with the infiltrators in the garrison's investigation, and the Media Hatchet people and their enablers are the prism through which young people today, and sadly a lot of older people, are seeing the JFK assassination. As Mort Saul so sagely observed, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? Jim, as something of a prelude...
By the way, I should interject this. Mm-hmm. Do you know that Mort Saul is up in the Bay Area now?
Yes, he is. He is still doing appearances up in Marin County.
Right. I just wanted to make sure you were aware of that.
Yes, he is. He is. And for young people, I'm not that much plugged into popular culture. So many of the comedians that I have been exposed to in recent years, I don't think are very funny at all. Mort Saul is funny.
he really is
funny.
Yes.
And so if people want to, he performs, I think, on Saturday nights someplace up in Marin County. He has a website, and people should undertake to go see him because he is.
I think, isn't it in Mill Valley?
It might be. It might be. It's somewhere in Marin.
Okay.
Certainly, he is a classic case of a living legend and also someone who gave up a great deal to pursue the truth. He was a major showbiz personality. He actually did some movies as well. There was an undistinguished Korean War movie in which he appeared with Sidney Poitier, among others. I think it was called All the Young Men. And he briefly riffed in that one, and that was he was really funny. So if people want to see what real comedy is like, Mort Saul is still performing. And he is someone who deserves the support of members of the listening audience. So, yes, he is up in Marin County and still doing live stand-up comedy. So there is a directive of sorts to the listening audience.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Jim, going to the people who defended Clayshaw and their interaction with the elements we have already been identifying with, we should perhaps very briefly review Guy Johnson, who we spoke about in our last interview.
Yeah, okay, we talked about this. Guy Johnson was a very accomplished attorney in private practice in New Orleans at the time, and he had a kind of refined background in intelligence work. He'd been in World War II as a Navy, he'd been in ONI also, and then he went into the ONI's after, and he became a reserve officer, and he was familiar and actually worked with people like Clayshaw and Guy Bannister. And he was announced as the first attorney for Shaw. And this, of course, later on, he decided to leave because of that reason. He was so closely associated with those two guys that they decided that there might have been a possibility, you know, that could be exposed. Now, the Wegmans were also, that is Bill and Ed Wegman, who did defend Shaw, okay, were also in that network, but not to the extensive degree that Guy Johnson was. So they managed to keep that hidden all the way until the declassified files of the ARB, when it was finally found out in the 1990s, okay, that they had an association with Bannister also. Now, Irvin Diamond, who ended up being the lead defense lawyer, I was never been able to find anything about an intelligence background with Diamond, although there's no question that once he became the chief defense lawyer, the lead defense lawyer, he bought into this whole thing and hid all the associations between Shaw's lawyers and Washington. And I should say, pleading Shaw's lawyers were to get help from the CIA and the FBI.
Washington. Yeah, Jim, dropped out just briefly. If you could restate your last couple of sentences, because you dropped out very briefly.
All right. Once Diamond became Shaw's lead lawyer,
right,
he fell in with this whole clandestine attempt by the Wegman brothers to get help from Washington. And in my book, I talk about this at length, that the Wegman brothers did everything they could to secure clandestine help from the FBI and the CIA, and they eventually got it, all right? And so by about 1968, as I write about, Irvin Diamond was cooperating with Hunter Leake, who was the station chief, the CIA station chief, you know, right there in New Orleans, out of the New Orleans office. And this continued all the way up to and including the trial of Clay Shaw, where the CIA station in New Orleans was forwarding daily clippings of the trial from both the newspapers, the Stateside and the Times-Picayune, and eventually they moved a ticker tape machine into the CIA station so they could go ahead and give real time. See, what they had is they had somebody at the courthouse. He would call in what was happening to the CIA station, and the CIA station would transmit it by a ticker. Maybe, should I explain what that was? Because maybe people don't understand what that is.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Because that is now outmoded technology. Yes, please.
Right. Back then, they didn't have all the high-tech cell phones and stuff that we have today. So a fast way to get messages through was to type them into what they called a ticker tape machine. And the ticker tape machine would be tied in with another ticker tape machine, and then they would get the message, you know, almost instantaneously in this other place, okay? And that's what the CIA did, all right? In addition, James Angleton was actually screening jurors, okay, in advance of Shaw's trial. So this is the kind of help, and the FBI was doing legwork for Shaw's defense before and during the trial, all right? So, and I describe all this in detail in my book, all right? And because, of course, none of this came out, and the other thing, of course, is that Diamond lied his head off about this. When I interviewed him in his office, you know, I asked him, I go, did you ever wonder why you were getting help? Okay, and he goes, well, it was the Kennedy assassination. He didn't want to tell the truth about how they were getting this clandestine help from the CIA and the FBI. And then I showed him a document. At that time, there had been one document released. See, the CIA has what they call a cleared attorneys panel, okay,
mm-hmm.
in throughout every major city in America. And this designates lawyers who will be happy to help if any kind of problem comes up, you know, on a kind of willy-nilly basis that wasn't, you know, foreseen. And they'll go into court and keep the relationship a secret. Well, I had found a little trace of this in one of the early releases by the ARB. And I showed it to Diamond. And Diamond, this is really funny, he walked out of his office, okay, went into another room, came back and said that guy's name there, James Quaid, he was convicted for fraud. Well, it turns out that Diamond knew Quaid, okay, and actually recruited him, okay, and the CIA took him with open arms, okay, into their little nest there to defend some of the defendants that Garrison had called into his office. So as far as I know, Diamond probably went into another room, called up the CIA, and said, what are you going to tell this guy? Okay, you know, he's in my office. He's got these documents. Okay, you know, and so...
By the way, Jim, I think it was our last interview before today. This has been 1045. I read the affidavit that Fred Lemons, who was the star witness in the Walter Sheridan NBC hit piece on Garrison, and his affidavit of what he went through in order to perjure himself, which he did on Walter Sheridan's special, and he mentions anonymous callers threatening him and or his family with bodily harm, saying that people in high places would see to it that he was taken care of, and also his networking directly with Irv Diamond in order to perpetuate the information that, or disinformation that he put on the Walter Sheridan interview, and he relayed Diamond's assurance that if Jim Garrison charged him with perjury, that he would, that he, Diamond, would see to it that he had counsel.
So, right, right. And that's where the cleared attorneys panel comes in.
Absolutely. So what we have here is the synthesis of Shaw's defense team, on the one hand, with the intelligence community, and also with the media, who are systematically misrepresenting the facts of the case. Again, I think maybe for a contemporary audience, the most important part, or certainly as important as any other part of your book. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what we're trying to describe here is this secret network that went on in New Orleans, which almost nobody exposed at the time. It's this association between Shaw's attorneys, the media, and Washington, in which they always tried to keep this a secret, that they were networking with each other in order to stymie Garrison. You know, because, and I think you said earlier, this is important, because Raymond Rocha said at the first meeting of the Garrison group, words to the effect that if Garrison is allowed to proceed, Shaw will be convicted. You know, and so then Helms sent out that order that we're going to do everything we can before, during, and after the trial of Clay Shaw to make sure that that doesn't happen. And boy, did they ever. Okay, and so this has been one, I believe, of the strongest aspects of the releases by the ARB. Okay, it's really kind of surprising, all this stuff, you know, that that has come out in that regard. It's been one of the richest areas of declassification. And I guess that was because there was a lot, you know, there was a lot there that remained hidden. Now, I don't have to tell you, Ray Rocha was one of James Angleton's chief assistants, all right? And in fact, as you mentioned earlier, I think, on one of these shows, that Ray Rocha was essentially James Angleton's man on the Warren Commission. And in fact, you'll see him as early as, I think, 1966, in Edward Epstein's book, Inquest, where he's credited as R. Rocha, all right? And he was, that's why he was interviewed, because he was a CIA's guy on the Warren Commission. He later became the CIA's guy on Jim Garrison. The amount of paper that the CIA produced on the Garrison investigation is utterly phenomenal. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say this. It would take five people 2 years working 40 hours a week to read all this stuff. That's how much paper was generated by the CIA on the Garrison investigation, and most of it went through Angleton's office. You know, and you got to wonder, why his office? You know, and as I write in my book, it's because I strongly suspect that Lee Harvey Oswald was working as an off-the-books agent for James Angleton. That's why I believe that was the case. You know, and so that's one of the reasons that the CIA went ahead and they took all these risks in exposing their domestic intelligence operations in order to make sure that Garrison did not succeed. You know, and as Garrison said, well, they succeeded in that endeavor, but I have to say they knew they were danced with once it was over.
Okay. Indeed. Jim, the Wegmans, tell us about them and how Wackenhut figures into this scenario. Might want to briefly explain to people what Wackenhut is.
All right. Well, Wackenhut today is renowned as a giant hydra of private intelligence. If you can afford them, okay, to do some work for you, you're getting like a mini FBI. That's how big they are. That's how powerful they are. Okay? Now, back in those days, they were known as a company called Southern Research. All right? And so the Wegmans went ahead and hired them, okay, to do as much work as they could. Now, this is what I should add here. A lot, and I mean a lot, of the people working for them back then were former FBI agents. That's what they were.
Yep.
Okay? So in other words, the reason you would, if you could afford them, the reason you wanted them working for you is because you knew that if there ever came a time push came to shove and they needed to get some information they couldn't get, that they would simply call one of their guys that they knew in the FBI that was still working there. He goes, can you make me a copy of this and mail it to me? At the, you know, okay. All right. And that's, of course, what would happen. All right. And so that is what happened in this case. A Southern researcher, later called Wackenhut, went to work for Clay Shaw's lawyers. Now, once you figure all this stuff out, okay, and I have most of this information in my book, if not all of it, the Shaw's lawyers were interfacing with the forerunner to Wackenhut, the State Department, the FBI, and the local CIA office. I mean, how much help can you possibly get?
Not only that, but in connection with that, the Media Hatchet people who were the public's eyes and ears on the investigation.
Right. And the CIA, as I put in my book, okay, the CIA went ahead and worked with certain judges. And see, we never knew why Garrison's his extradition and subpoena orders, so many of them were turned down. Well, now we know, because the CIA would send their legal counsel out to the receiving judge and advise them, please do not serve that subpoena on Alan Dulles, okay? Please do not serve that subpoena on Richard Helms, okay? And they would come back unserved. Sometimes they would actually, I think I have at least one case in my book, where they actually talked to the originating judge in New Orleans and compromised him. All right? So this is the kind of thing that you had, which nobody knew about at the time. And by keeping it all secret, of course, when Garrison would talk about this stuff, it was easy to caricature him as some kind of loon. Okay, what is he talking? Come on, what does he really think that we would, the CIA and the FBI would do stuff like that? You know, see, and back in those days, you know, it was possible before the discoveries of the Church Committee in 1975, 1976, you know, it was possible to actually believe, oh, those guys wouldn't do anything like that. Now, of course, after the Church Committee, it was almost impossible to believe, okay? But at that time, it was, you know? And so Garrison had every possible disadvantage that you could pretty much imagine working against him.
Jim, we've got about 15 minutes left in this interview. If you could briefly tell us about Sal Ponseca, that was a new name from your book. And then I'd like to talk about someone who was the Attorney General at the time and has become a luminary in the so-called progressive sector, that is Ramsey Clark. Tell us briefly about Sal Ponseca.
Sal Ponseca was like the junior partner in the Wegman law firm, all right? And he was like a leg man, okay? But he did know everything that was happening, and he helped cover up how the Wegmans found out about one of the most disastrous witnesses that Garrison produced at the trial, a guy named Charles Spicel. Okay, he had put out this story that he had a neighbor who knew Spicel. I found the documents that the FBI was tracking down Spicel in New York at the time. Okay, if your listeners don't know, this is the guy who said that he fingerprinted his daughter when she got back from college,
right?
Because he wanted to know if it was the same girl he sent there. Okay, and that, of course, ended up being a disaster for Garrison. He writes about this in his book, On the Trail of the Assassins. All right. Ponseca then went on to be, because I interviewed him down in New Orleans, he went on to be, as most of these guys were, very, very prosperous and very, very established lawyers in New Orleans after the fact. He was another guy that always denied that the defense team was getting help from the CIA and the FBI. And, of course, like I said, this has all turned out to be baloney, okay? And so that's another aspect of Shaw's defense team. Now, Ramsey Clark, for people who don't know, Ramsey Clark was appointed by Lyndon Johnson to be the Attorney General after Bobby Kennedy decided to leave in about 64. Nicholas Katzenbach filled in a while, and then Johnson appointed Ramsey Clark as the new Attorney General. Today, Ramsey Clark has this reputation as being a very progressive, very humane, very liberal kind of a guy, you know, who usually can be counted on to be counter the establishment. A lot of people believe, as I do, is that he's actually doing penance for all the terrible things he did back in the 1960s, all right? Concerning the Martin Luther King assassination, the Bobby Kennedy assassination, and the JFK case. On the JFK case, it's really interesting. Clark was so intent upon covering up for Clay Shaw when Garrison indicted him that he made a mistake, what they call a gaffe in the trade, and he said that the Justice Department had checked out Clay Shaw at the time of the assassination, and they found out that he was clean. Now, obviously, as any enterprising reporter would ask, you know, which but somehow Clark did not foresee, the next question is, Mr. Clark, why would the FBI be checking on Shaw back in 1963 and 1964? All right. And then, of course, it turned out that Clark was actually telling the truth. Okay. The FBI was checking up on Shaw in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. And that didn't come out again until the 1990s. We didn't know that. But an enterprising reporter went down to the Justice Department, and in an off-the-record interview, somebody told him that the FBI concluded back then that Clay Shaw was Clay Bertrand, which, of course, turned out to be true. All right? And so then the FBI got very angry at Clark, and they told him, you know, will you shut your blithering mouth? Okay? Don't take any more questions on this. Don't talk about Jim Garrison, et cetera. All right, because you're getting us in a heap of, you know, contradictions. All right, just ignore it from here on in, which, of course, is what happened. Now, the other thing that Ramsey Clark is noted for is that as this was heating up in 1967, 1968, now, if you recall, maybe some of us aren't old enough to, but back then, you had a series of books that came out, all right, and some of them became bestsellers, like Josiah Thompson's book, 6 Seconds in Dallas, made the cover of, I think, the Saturday Evening Post or the Saturday Review or something like that, all right, and you had articles in the New York Review of Books by a guy named Richard Pompkin, who actually wrote about Garrison's investigation in a favorable way, all right? And so this was beginning to generate some controversy. So a couple of lawyers who worked on the Warren Commission, David Slauson and Wesley Liebler, okay? Slauson, I think, was in the Justice Department at that time. They suggested that we do everything we can to put a kibosh on this, all right? And they suggested in doing it through the medical evidence. And evidently, that request was heard by Ramsey Clark. And so Ramsey Clark, in 1968, convened a special medical panel to review the medical evidence in the JFK case. Now, I cannot tell you how interesting the results of that so-called review were, because, first of all, the guy who conducted the review, okay, a famous a coroner from Baltimore named Russell Fisher, later admitted that the reason the panel was called, one of their aims was to neutralize the junk in Josiah Thompson's book, okay? Because Thompson had done some work on the medical evidence, you know, and he said, well, look at this. I mean, how can a bullet coming in at the base of JFK's skull, you know, if you match it up with the Zapruder film, how can it emerge at a higher point above and to the right of his right ear? How would something like that happen? Because it turned out that the Warren Commission had lied about this. You know, in their diagrams, they had pointed JFK's head downward at a much further angle than it was at the moment of impact, which is Z-frame 313. All right, and so what happened is that they convened this medical panel. And guess what? Even though it was convened in 1968, do you know when they announced their results? On the eve of the Clay Shaw trial in 1969. All right? They waited for that strategic point to announce it. And they said that they agreed with the original autopsy. But here was the problem that almost, again, that nobody in the media pointed out. The Ramsey-Clark panel did three things in which they actually altered the original evidence. And nobody brought this out at the time. Okay, number one, they moved the fatal headshot from the bottom of Kennedy's skull to the top of his skull. And they did that, of course, because of what Thompson did in his book, to make it seem more logical that a bullet coming in at the top of the skull would exit through the right front of his head. The second thing they did is they allegedly discovered, and I want to put that word in quotes, a 6.5 millimeter circular fragment in the back of Kennedy's head. Now, I don't have to tell you why they did that, right, Dave? Because the ammunition allegedly used in this case was a 6.5 millimeter bullet. They miraculously discovered a fragment of a 6.5 bullet, which none of the doctors in the previous autopsy, when they had the body right in front of them, noticed.
We could perhaps term that the immaculate inception.
But you want to hear the capper to that?
Oh, I'd
love
to.
The capper to that is that fragment has to be from the middle of the bullet, because the front end of the bullet and the back end of the bullet ended up in the car, the front seat of the car. So as many people have said, how the hell does a bullet break up into three parts and the middle of the bullet stays in the back of the, I mean, did the back of the bullet just beep, beep, rose above and went over the middle of the bullet? Is that what happened? All right?
Jim, in
connection
with this.
And then the third thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Then the third thing, I hope everybody's still sitting down. Okay, the third thing that's so strange about this is that in the original autopsy report, Commander Humes, the chief pathologist, said that there was a trail of particles that led from the low back of the skull to the upper right-hand side of the head. Okay, now when the ARB, in the form of Jeremy Gunn, their chief counsel, put the X-ray in front of James Humes and said, this is your report. You see here what you wrote about these particles that went from the lower back of the head to the front? Can you show me where they are in this X-ray? And Humes looked at the X-ray and said, I don't see them. They must have been there since I wrote about them, but I don't see them in this X-ray now. So this is the kind of crap that Ramsey-Clark pulled on the American public, and nobody screamed about it. Nobody said, well, wait a minute, how did an autopsy change like that? How do particles disappear? How do 6.5 millimeter fragments appear? How do bullets get elevated in the head?
Jim, you know? We have not spoken much in the interviews we've done about the physical evidence. I went into that at greater length in my old Guns of November. Suffice to say, the physical evidence is just complete fantasy, that no one who has completed the seventh grade could possibly take it at face value. It is absolutely ludicrous, and we'll perhaps in the future interview talk about that. We're going to get into the actual trial in our next interview. However, we are almost out of time. After hearing what Ramsey-Clark did, I certainly think people should, well, factor that into their assessment of him. Jim, tell us about where people can order Destiny Betrayed, JFK, The Evidence Today, and also about Kennedys and King and Blackout Radio.
All right. I have a website called kennedysandking.com. And if you want to order my last two books, which is The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and the book we're discussing, okay, Destiny Betrayed, you can go ahead and punch through there. and order those two books from my website. And I'm a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's show called Black Op Radio, which you can listen to on Thursday nights at 6:30.
All righty. So if people would like to pursue this evidence, or pursue the information, and I emphatically recommend that they get a hold of Destiny Betrayed, that is how they can do that. This concludes For the Record program number 1047, interview number 16 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 8th, of the year 2019. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.